Hello and welcome to Therapy Entrepreneurs and Leaders of Color, a podcast dedicated to showcasing therapy entrepreneurs and leaders of color around the world. It is all about sharing their stories, inspiring others, and supporting them in their roles. I always say I'm so excited, but I'm extra so excited today. Our guest is Dr. Ann Elizabeth Jenkins, who is an educator, an occupational therapist, and an ordained minister. She has almost 50 years of extensive and varied experiences in rehab, therapy, and education. Dr. Jenkins taught the only Afrocentric class from kindergarten to third grade, supported in a North Carolina public school system after desegregation between 1995 and 1998. She owned an occupational therapy private practice and private charter school for special needs kids from kindergarten through 12th grade. Dr. Jenkins serves as a national and international healthcare consultant. She has traveled on mission trips to developing countries in Africa, Asia, and South America. Collegiate teaching includes New York University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and Winston-Salem State University. Dr. Jenkins was elected twice to serve in the Representative Assembly as a representative for internationally based OT practitioners. She is currently retired and serves as a board member for Winston-Salem State's Occupational Therapy Department. She also serves as an associate pastor in a local community church. In addition, Dr. Jenkins is the co-president of Forsyth County AARP, as well as a North Carolina State AARP volunteer. She has an adult son, August, who lives in Durham, North Carolina, two adult grandchildren, and two great-grandchildren. Isn't that an amazing bio? I mean, if we had an audience, I know they would be on their feet doing a, you know, giving a standing ovation. And I know Dr. Jenkins, she and I worked together, and I was drawn to you when I taught at Winston-Salem State. One of the first Black OT professors I met, but I felt like there was just a connection spiritually. And then I was just admiring how you were living life. You know, we would come into meetings and you say, oh, I'm going to ride 15 miles on my bicycle today. And I was just very inspired. And we're going to get to another story that later in this podcast that really struck me. So you definitely want to hang on and continue to listen. But welcome, Dr. Jenkins, to the show.
Thank you.
So glad to have you here. Can you talk to us about, you know, who you are in your own words and how you became interested in occupational therapy?
Originally, I became interested in occupational therapy as a patient in the OT clinic at Staten Island Hospital. I was in an accident, in a mail truck accident. At the time, I was working for the U.S. Post Office, and the mail truck slammed into one of the pillars that holds up the train station. If anybody's ever been to New York, not all train stations are underground. Some tracks are above ground. But anyway, and I suffered from amnesia and was taken to Staten Island Hospital and was referred to occupational therapy. And I realized towards the end of my treatment time there that that might be something that I would like to pursue. It involved the medical field, which I was interested in going into, but also the arts and just being creative and helping people regain function. And that seemed to fit all of my passions. I moved from New York City to Winston-Salem, North Carolina in 1977. And I couldn't find a job. I couldn't find a job in teaching, even though I was certified in a number of areas. And I couldn't find a job as an occupational therapist because I'm Black. And any of the places that I applied said I couldn't be an OT. I could be an assistant or a recreation aide, but I certainly couldn't be an OTR because there were no OTRs that they were aware of or that they had ever interacted with. So my entrepreneurial idea was essentially born out of necessity. I decided, well, since they won't give me a job here, I'll have to create my own job, create my own business. And so I knew that I had skills as an OT as well as an educator. So I attended one of the public forums for serving special needs children, started networking and gaining support from some of the pediatric clinical practitioners that were in psychology as well as neurology. That's really how it all began. Just writing up a business plan, seeking out the necessary help, how much space, what types of materials, writing up a budget plan, scoping out what I would need in terms of manpower, pulling it all together with the licenses that I would need. And also, if I was going to accept insurance, then I needed to get a vendor's or a provider number is what they call them now. So I knew of the larger insurance companies and some of the psychologists and neurologists that I had been working with helped me get those papers filled out and submitted to the various insurance companies. And I started with an in-home clinic on the lower level of my home, which was very accommodating because it was a direct entry from the driveway into the entrance to my clinic. I had a whirlpool. I had adequate space for doing work with young ones on the mats and therapy balls and that kind of thing. So I had an ideal setting in the home that I lived in, and I had support from people that really wanted to see me succeed. And I want to say that those people were not from North Carolina. And as a result, because not from Winston-Salem. Winston-Salem is a very tight-knit place, and either you're born here and you belong here, or if you're an outsider, especially a New Yorker, people are more suspicious and suspect without even getting to know you.
I have a question, Dr. Jenkins. Uh-huh. You moved from New York to North Carolina, and when you came to North Carolina, people hadn't seen a Black OT, so they wouldn't hire you. And then, so you decided to start this business, which sounds like an amazing business where you have whirlpools and this state-of-the-art equipment in your home, and you have support from other people out of state. Were you able to treat people who are not Black in your business?
Yes.
Kids? So you had kids coming to you?
The majority of my clients were not Black.
Interesting.
The supporters were Caucasians who were established clinicians in the Winston area, and they had lucrative practices. And as a matter of fact, the child neurologist was able to tie me into Winston-Salem Healthcare, which was a part of the Reynolds Tobacco Company and service for their employees and families. So, yeah, a majority of my clients were not Black. Even though my ambition was to serve those that needed it, those clients were not accessible at that time, at the very beginning. It wasn't until I opened up my private school here in Winston, which was the second of the schools that I opened up, because the first school that I opened up was located in Lexington, North Carolina, in a restored barn. And I had 12 children to work with. And the building was burned, and the accused, and the supposedly culprits were the Klan. And the reason they were strongly suspected was because a burning cross with a white hood was left at the scene of the burned building, which was, of course, very devastating because I lost a lot of material. It just burned to the ground. Nobody knew anything. And I was living in Winston, but having to travel to Lexington to have my business operate as the school. And it was just devastating. So I had to start over again. But again, with this support system that I had worked with and been a part of and developed relationships with, they encouraged me to relocate in Winston-Salem in a brownstone, which I had two floors to use. And the brownstone owner had a great reduction in the rent for the space because she understood the importance of what I was doing. So that was helpful as well. And I'm glad that I did pursue and run that school. It was Piedmont Achievement Center in the downtown area of Winston-Salem. The surrounding community was much more supportive, and that helped in getting some things done as far as businesses contributing services. The auto rental place on Broad Street would allow us to rent a van for $20 to rent a van when we had to take our students to different programs and on field trips. Judo place over on Stratford, they provided group sessions for the special needs students, grouping them by age. And it was just minimal. I think they charged $1.50 or something per child for the lessons. And then we could walk to the Y, and the director of aquatics provided swim lessons for our students. We had music teacher and all come in. So we had tremendous support locally, just centered around where the school was situated.
And we talked a little bit about this before we got started, how important location is. And it sounds like it was a good move. Unfortunately, you know, that was a very tragic reason behind why you originally moved. And I do want to just pause for a minute and thank you for sharing that, because you shared it. And we talked about this before we got started. You shared that in a meeting that the North Carolina OT Association had when we were trying to start a special interest section for entrepreneurs. And I remember when you said it, and you just said it and we just continued with the conversation, and I was just staring, thinking what strength you must have in order to build a business. You know, first of all, you move, you relocate, they're not giving you a chance. You have to figure it out. You have to, you know, come up with your startup. You have to write your business plan. You have to meet people who think differently. Then you build something and it's burned by the Klan, most likely based on the cross and the hood. And then you get right back up, you know, and you thrive in a different, you know, a different location. And I think about it often. That was years ago when you shared it at the conference, but I think about it often as a Black entrepreneur with some of my challenges. And I remember that story to say, okay, get back up. There's another way to do this. You know, there's some people who hate, there are still some people who love, there are still some people who care from different backgrounds, and you have to find those people and have those to be, you know, part of your network. So I just applaud you for being the strong person that you are, a woman, African-American therapist, leader in our profession. I am so grateful for you sharing that story and for you just being who you are. So you started another business. This one thrives and you're doing really well. And then somehow you get into academia. Can we talk about how you become a leader in the profession internationally and become a professor?
With the school that I created, Piedmont Achievement Center, I was working with special needs populations, and the local school system refused to contract services with me, even though those children were, most of them anyway, were Forsyth County residents. They felt that those students could thrive in the regular public school, but the parents felt differently, and the students felt differently. And their experience in my special program allowed them to thrive in ways that public school could not offer. And I think part of that was because of my OT background, as well as my background in teacher education. I was able to address all of the physical, social, and emotional needs and make classroom modifications and adaptive equipment and that kind of thing, and knowing sensory integration and so forth, that the students were able to do exceptionally well. As a matter of fact, most of the students who went back to public school no longer qualified for special needs because they were too high functioning. Whereas before, they were being discarded as probably non-productive, having very little to offer society, and just being categorized as rejections, that's all. But in serving the children, I wanted to reach the most vulnerable. And being a special needs child and coming from a family that has very little income has always been a concern of mine. So I wanted to take in as many children as I could from that area. Well, the problem with that, it's wonderful to have a great heart. It really is. But there are some reality factors. There are costs involved. And when you have paying versus non-paying, you can do less. You do less than if you have full paying. I was not aware at the time that I could have been seeking special funds from social services and some other interested community groups that would have sponsored these students in the program. But it wasn't until I was left with about $25 in my savings account that I thought, you know what, Ann Jenkins, you might need to do something else. You can't keep doing this. Because I was providing for four teachers. I had contracted physical therapy and speech therapy. And I was doing OT after school hours and on weekends to try to make things balance out. But it eventually affected my health, and I had to decide, what do I do from here? And when I looked over what I had done for the 7 years, the school was in operation for 7 years, I felt that I needed to give that up, try to get into the public school system where I could share with other teachers some of the nuggets that I had learned and what would help make a productive learning system for them. I tried getting back in, getting into the school system. It was because one of the church members was a member of the personnel group at the school system. She was the one who pulled my file and sent it to a principal, because evidently I had been blackballed. I wasn't aware of this until that time. And she sent me to, this church member sent me to a principal who decided to hire me. And then the ball started rolling and the contract was signed. So that's how that shift was made from the business angle. But I still maintained my private practice, where I was doing consulting, supervising CODAs in various school systems. And I arranged to be on their sites on days where we had holidays with the school system that I was employed in. So it worked out well in that way.
And then you go on to get your doctorate and you become a professor.
Yeah.
How did you do all that while you were?
Well, I realized that working with the families, with so many different family styles and family ways of being, that I needed something more than what I had. And an important aspect of the life of these families centered around religion, their spirituality. And so I thought, well, I need that spiritual piece. How? And then I would have it all wrapped up nice and tight. So I did, I went to two seminaries. I went to Virginia Union and got the Black theology part of it, and some more good grounding in Christian education. And then I went to, in Boston, Gordon Theological Seminary, got my doctorate in working in ministry with postmoderns. And the postmodern bit was because a lot of the children were living with their grandparents who were young. Mm. their parents were really, really young. And usually it was a single parent who left their child with their parent. So now the grandparent is raising the child. But I needed an additional way to get through to the families and try to make a holistic way of treatment become a reality. And that proved to be successful. I know in public school, you're not supposed to talk religion, but the way I put it, we were talking about humanity and we were talking about our place in space on Earth and how that relates to a higher power. Mm-hmm. So there was no specific dogma or religious philosophy espoused, which perturbed my pastor. But I realized that people have some common needs, mm-hmm. and then some people have some very unique needs, and those have to be addressed. And the spiritual route, that finding out what is meaningful to them, what do they have faith in, what do they believe in, how do they get themselves going? That part of it is important. And I feel like I've accomplished that.
I'm so glad that you said that, because sometimes people think if you are spiritual or you love your religion, that means you can't talk about anything but your religion, and you can't work with anybody, someone who believes the exact same thing that you believe. And, you know, spirituality is part of our practice framework. So I'm glad that you were addressing that before it was considered the right thing to do. You already knew it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
But did you think you were going to become a professor when you got, so it sounds like you got the doctorate degree because you wanted to make sure that you were meeting a certain need with the population you were serving?
I was close to retirement when I got my doctorate. So, I was in my 60s then. I love teaching. I mean, I don't sing and I really can't dance that well. But I love teaching, and I'm really good at it. And an opportunity became available for me to teach other OTs how to be OTs. And so the courses I taught were the foundational, you know, what is OT? And I really love teaching that, because they came in all, you know, pumped up. Oh, I know what OT is. I'm going to be an OT, you know, pass all these courses. And it's like, sweetheart, you don't really know what OT is. So I would have them on the first day of class, 8:00 in the morning, Monday. That was my class, to write out what is occupational therapy. And I would hold that, the little index card, until they did their senior project. And then have them write on the back of their cards what occupational therapy is. And so many of them were like, a few of them were even in tears. And this happened repeatedly year after year. Oh, I thought I knew something, but I found out differently. Yeah. The wonderful thing about occupational therapy is it is life. It's about life. Mm-hmm. It's about living it. Facing the challenges, being creative in moving through those challenges and coming out on the other side victorious. It's all of that. And so, yeah, I'm grateful that I, even though I'm retired, I'm still basically an OT.
I can tell you're still contributing in many ways. Can we talk a little bit about your international experience? And I'm really curious about this because I have a I don't know if it's, I say as a secret, but I've never been out of the United States. So I've not traveled out of the U.S. And so I know we have, you know, and I want to go. So I'm like, I'm ready to go, ready to go. I have my passport. My son even went out. He went to Argentina for exchange trip a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And I said, oh, you're not going by yourself. I'm going with you. So I got my passport. And then I thought about it because it was a student experience. And I said, okay, mama's not going to go and be all up in your business on this trip. I'll go another time. And now, you know, COVID came and I still have the passport. I'm just waiting for the time for me to, you know, to be able to travel internationally. But
yeah,
but you're, you know, we have some similar backgrounds that we've talked about in the past. You know, you talk about, you know, coming from a background where you don't necessarily have the money to be thinking about getting on an airplane and taking your trip overseas with your family for this luxurious vacation. So it never really was part of my world growing up. And I think for you, the same. So how did you
when I was at Virginia Union, in the senior class, the professor would arrange a trip for the seniors to go to Ghana. And he said, if you're going to be teaching Black people, you need to go where Black people originated. And so it was a 10-day trip to Ghana in Accra, and we went to some other places in Ghana as well to see the slave ships and slave caves and all of that, and the plantations and different museums and so forth. But that trip was an eye opener for me. Just landing in Accra and getting off the plane, people welcome you. Oh, my sister, you know, you don't even know these people. Oh, my sister, you're home. You're from the States, but you're home now. It was such a welcoming and warm experience. And I had, I was going to focus on the role of religion as it related to education, because we each had to have a project that we were going to work on. It wasn't just a free luxury trip given by the school. And one of the things that I found out, and this is true for many African countries as well as this Asian and South American countries, the people live their religion. They live their religious practices. If your brother is struggling, you help him out, regardless of the cost. And you see that. And the children know this. They recite this. The children, they know the Bible. They quote passages and everything. And they know the history of their home. They know the history of their country. Very, very respectful of elders. They live in the expectation that life is going to get better. We did visit some of the orphanages with HIV AIDS children, because the families had died. That's why the children were there. And some good-hearted people from the village decided to erect this building and provide for these children who were abandoned by death of the other family members. And having lost their families and still being so hopeful helped me tremendously, because I've lost two children tragically and was going through a grieving process. But it was more like, well, look at these young children. They don't have a mom, a dad, a granny, auntie, nobody. You have a home to live in. You have a job. You have a family left. what are you crying about? Just what are you crying about? They have nobody, and they're not educated, and they have very, excuse me, limited opportunities of living a full life, yet they were full of hope. So, yeah, I learned a lot about ways of being in this earth and moving forward, not letting its challenges stop you because of the tragic situations, the drama, and some of the trauma.
I appreciate you sharing that. One of the things I really like about this podcast is that the guests that we've had have been very transparent in sharing stories. And in my experience, I will just speak for myself, certain topics have been like taboo professionally. You know, some, like maybe if you had a physical disability, you could talk about that and everybody would listen in on that if that's part of your occupational history. But if there were other things that were part of your occupational history, it makes, maybe made people feel uncomfortable and it would be very obvious. So you kind of picking and choosing what you share. But I'm really thankful for you sharing and for other guests in the past sharing, because we don't know who's listening to this and how that might inspire them and give them hope, you know, based on, you know, your experiences and how you've overcame certain things that were tragic in your life, and how you looked at it and how other people helped you to look at it in a different way so that you can still thrive in life, which is what you're doing, what you're still doing. So I guess it was very natural for you to then become become the representative for internationally based OT with WFIT. Because I saw the pictures. I saw you up there with one of my previous professors, Dr. Sue Coppola. And I said, look at
Where's she at now? I just talked to her last month. Yeah. That was very intentional. That WFOT position was very intentional. The history of AOTA to me has been a headstone with only whites in leadership. And I wanted to change that. I wasn't aiming to be the president or any of those executive hold any of those executive positions. I wanted something more meaningful and more expansive. And this World Federation of OT is wider than just AOTA. It encompasses all the OTs in the world.
Yeah.
Which is such a wonderful arena to participate in. My intention was to show therapists of color that you don't have to stay in the backyard. You can open the gate and walk through to this rest of the world.
Amen.
And so I started looking to find out how do you get to be a representative? And, you know, there's this electoral process and a small window for campaigning, and there are criteria to meet. So I crafted my professional endeavors to meet those criteria. And so when it was time for the election, I submitted my application as a nominee and won the vote of the national, which really surprised me because I was not well known. I was known to the Black OTs because I was instrumental in developing the Black OT caucus for AOTA. I laid the groundwork with the ladies in Atlanta, Georgia, years back.
I didn't know that. I'm learning something new about you.
Yeah, years back. So I got to travel to Taiwan, Santiago, Chile. Bolivia, just all over. Oh, Tokyo. I've been to Tokyo several times, but just a number of wonderful, wonderful places. And I have friends now in all those places, you know, still networking, still staying in contact, because they'll want me to provide my perspective on some research article they're writing or a conference that they're developing. And, you know, and Sue invited me to be a part of this conference that's going to be talking about social justice and how that impacts occupational justice. So we wrote up a proposal for that, and we're waiting to hear back on that. So it's an opportunity to really see what the rest of the world is doing and get the true story. Mm-hmm. You don't always get the true story through media, but when you go and you interact with the people and get entrenched in the culture, you see from a different perspective than the one that was fed to you in the States.
Mm, yeah.
And it just gives you a greater appreciation for human life. That yes, people are different, but people have basically the same needs.
Mm, I love that. People are different, but we have basically the same needs. I need to send you an offering. I'm sending you an offering, Dr. Jenkins. Look, as they say in my church, you preach it right. You preach it right now. So we talked already a lot about the challenges. I was going to ask the question about the challenges, but I think we've talked about that. I do want, before we close, I do want to circle back to AOTA and how it was ran predominantly by white females, and how this year we have more representation, people of color, than I think I've ever seen in my 20 years of practice. Dr. Rocky, who's a guest, is now the vice president. Dr. Victoria, yes, and she's Black and Iranian. We have a she's Latinx. Dr. Victoria was also a guest. She's on the board. Andre Johnson, Black male, he's on the board. So this has been a phenomenal this past election, a phenomenal shift. But I saw exactly what you were talking about in the past before this took place. It's like, why don't we see more people of color in leadership with AOTA? So I'm very hopeful that there will be some change there. And I'm looking forward to this talk that you and Sue have put together. I'm hoping that gets selected, because I'm really interested in social justice and occupational justice and how social enterprises are able to address occupational social justices. So, and I've never been to a WFOT conference. I think it's at the same time as AOTA in 2022, but I know it only comes four times.
They generally dovetail on one another. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So looking forward to that. Well, any last words of wisdom? You dropped it. Like I said, I need to send you an offering because you dropped so many nuggets in this talk today. But is there any last words of wisdom or advice that you'd like to give to OTs who are listening? Particularly OTs of color who might want to go into leadership or entrepreneurial roles, and they're scared, they have fear, they're looking for wisdom. What would you say to them?
Be your authentic self. That's the best self that you can be. And I have this mindset, this theory about a mindset for success. And the first thing is always seek knowledge. You always should be seeking out the truth. Be intentional. Stay focused. Put your heart into what you're doing. Be vulnerable. That is, be open and susceptible to criticism. Not everybody's going to like what you're doing, but hear them out and hear what's being said and honestly evaluate what's being said. Even though you don't like what's said, maybe there's an element of truth in there that you need to consider. Don't be so full of yourself that you feel you're finished. You're not finished until they put the dirt and say the last rites. You know, that's the finish. Allow for some ambiguity in your life. Things in life are not always for certain, for sure. So you have to live with some faith. Have some hope and trust that if you're moving in the path that God has laid out for you, it certainly will be a golden road.
I love all of that. I'm going to write all of that down in my journal. I'm going to go back and rewind and write that out, put it up before me, because it really is about faith. You know, walking forward, that you're not going to have all the answers, and to be able to be vulnerable as well as humble to accept, or at least listen, because sometimes, you know, everybody think they're right. You know, I think I'm right. They got their argument. They think they're right. So if no one is listening to each other, then how can you ever grow? You're not in relationships with people who are different from you with different perspectives. How can you grow? And it sounds like you've done a wonderful job of still being open-minded, still growing, and still having faith, even when you had challenges and tragedy and, you know, just that whole getting back up. And you, and in person, y'all, if you can ever meet her, I mean, Dr. Jenkins is so full of life. Like I said, you come into these meetings talking about your mountain bike and what you're getting ready to do next. And so, you know.
I'm doing music theory and violin now.
Oh, you're playing the violin?
Yes.
Awesome. That is awesome. Well, thank you so much for taking the time out of your schedule today to talk with us. It is extremely inspiring, and we will continue to
look forward
to all what you're going to continue to contribute, because I know you're not going to stop. You're just going to keep contributing to our profession.
So, keep going.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Thank you all for listening. Don't forget to follow us. Until next time.